This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. Mary Roach is the best-selling author of Stiff, The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers, 6 Feet Over, Adventures in the Afterlife, Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex, and Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in Space. She has written for The Guardian, Wired, BBC Focus, GQ and Vogue, among many other publications. And her latest book, which was out earlier this month, is Gulp, Adventures on the Alimentary Canal. So, Mary, welcome back to Little Atoms, first of all. It's great to have you back.
Well, thank you for having me back. Always a pleasure.
A common thread through all of your work is the ickiness of the human body and its interactions with science and things. It's an area that keeps cropping up, and this book really tackles that idea head on, doesn't it?
I think it doesn't get any ickier. Yeah. See, I don't know where I could possibly go from here.
What's this book about?
Well, Gulp is the alimentary canal, which is kind of an old-timey term for the whole human food processor from nose to tail, from their whole food chute, the pie hole, the whole 9 yards. Isn't it about 9 yards?
Yeah, about 9 yards. The whole digestive system. The format of the book is you work from the mouth to the other end. Being a bit polite now, but I'm sure by the end of this interview, we'll be dropping that. Yeah, so it starts in that format. So you begin with the mouth, and actually taste is the first thing you look at. Or really, I should say smell, because although it's about the mouth, smell is obviously critical to how we taste, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. When the term flavor is a combination of taste and smell, but it's something like 80% smell. So you are doing, you're smelling your food not just when it's on the plate, but when it's in the mouth, because you have a set, and this I love because I had no idea, a set of internal nostrils. It's opening in the back of the mouth, so these volatile gases, these aromas, waft up into the nasal cavity where the olfactory epithelium is. So your experience of the pleasures of food is more smell than taste. It's more, I mean, taste is kind of a shirt and pants, is sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and that other one.
Umami,
who somebody invited to the party at some point.
It's made up, I think.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Somehow it's in there. But anyway, those are the basics, but then it's just almost infinite variety of everything from chocolate to lemon and vanilla and black cherry and melon and all those words that people toss around when they taste wine. All of that is in the nose. That's all happening when molecules of gas go up into the nose and we experience them as these delightful sensations. And so, yeah, your nose is where it's at.
Well, you mentioned wine there. I mean, everyone will be familiar with the sight of people taking big gulps from a glass of red wine and big gulps of breath, I mean, and smelling and coming up with all of those things that it smells like. But in the book, you do a similar thing with olive oil. Tell me about that. There's olive oil tasters, right?
Yeah, I went to the tryouts for the olive oil flavor panel, taste panel. Should be called a flavor panel, technically speaking. I saw on their website, the Olive Center, which is up in Napa Valley where the wine people are, I saw that they were having tryouts for the olive tasting panel. I thought, well, that'd be a nice way to humiliate myself. So I went up and I tried out, and as it turns out, I have no aptitude for tasting olive oil. And the reason is, it doesn't have to do with my having a genetically inferior nose. It has more to do with that I don't have any experience with tasting and smelling olive oil. And to a certain extent, there's, all of those adjectives that people apply to wine or olive oil or beer, well, a lot of that is marketing. There's also, when you can study kind of the reference molecules for those individual smells and learn them. It's like learning vocabulary. Mm-hmm. So if you're in the olive oil industry, and people in there, in that room, I was the only idiot who'd come from outside the world of olives and olive oil, but those folks they were able to easily identify some elements of olive oil that to me were, I had no idea. I couldn't even tell that the olive oil I'd been presented with was rancid. I'm like, yeah, this is pretty good. Does anybody have any bread? I couldn't tell. And the European olive oil makers know this, and they they dump a lot of inferior olive oil on the United States because we're fine with it. We're not educated. You can educate your nose in a way that I didn't realize by just, and you can buy kits. Like for red wine, there's something called Le Nez du Vin, where it's these little bottles that have the aroma of black cherry, say. So if you learn to identify that, then you could pick that out as a component of what's going on in your mouth. But it's really hard to do that. And it's hard to apply label to a smell because we're very visual creatures. Mm-hmm. We are raised to put labels onto things we see, not things we smell. So you have to kind of rewire yourself a little bit, just rework your sensory priorities.
Yeah, and tests have been done on people tasting things blindfold, for instance, and how much that affects just our ability to identify between similar tasting things.
Yeah, that's right. And there was that amazing study done in the University of Bordeaux where they gave wine, they were high-level wine students, and they gave them a red and a white wine and had them write descriptions using those words that people use for red wine and white wine. And then they gave them another pairing of red wine and white wine, but in this case, the red wine was actually the same white wine, but with red coloring. And the descriptions were now words that you would apply to red wine, and not to say that they're phonies or boobs. They were allowing their visual cues to trump whatever their nose and mouth were telling them, and that's normal. That's what we do.
That's what we all do.
Yeah.
Olive oil in Europe is obviously grown in... The olives are grown in the same climatic conditions as wine. So in Northern California, you'd think would be a good place to grow olive oil. Is there a nascent olive oil industry over there?
Yeah, there is. There's the Robert Mondavi Institute, which started out as just wine, science of wine and winemaking, has opened up something called the Olive Center. And that's where I did the tryout. Yeah, and it's part of UC Davis, and it's right in the wine country. Yeah, so all along it is the same climate. You're right, same conditions for growing wine. So the olive people have been like, hey, how can we get a piece of this action? You know, we need. So they're setting up tastings. The panel, I should say, the panel isn't just for people to go, oh, I'm getting melon and pawpaw with a little finish of pepper. It's not for that. It's actually to help industry. When somebody has a batch of olive oil that is off, there's something wrong, they can take it to one of these panels, these professional sensory analysts, and that person can do a kind of forensics, olfactory forensics, where they can say, okay, I'm getting a manure flavor, smell, whatever. That suggests you've got some sediment in your tanks that you need to clean out, because this is what happens when that, you know, you have this problem leads to this smell. So they're kind of scent detectives. They can use these clues, these defects in the olive oil that they can detect with their nose, are then leading them toward a problem in the manufacturing process. So it is a kind of a weird job, but very important to the industry. They're trying to get also tastings with consumers involved and coming in and doing tastings and learning about olive oil. So they're trying to do with olive oil what has been done for wine and to a certain extent beer.
So we've just been talking about olive oil, and that's a delightful thing to taste, regardless of the fact that, you know, you couldn't tell nice olive oil from rancid olive oil. But a little later in the book, you go to a place where they are basically tasting pet food.
Yeah.
So tell me about that visit.
Yeah, I spent a day at AFB International where they make palatants, and palatants are the coatings on kibble. Kibble itself has very little flavor. It's kind of like a Cheeto. So they're experts in pet taste and smell. And they're doing taste tests with dogs and cats. And obviously you can't have the animal fill out a form or tell you how much it enjoyed what you just served it. So they've got people who are very adept at interpreting the animal's behavior when they're eating. For example, and it's not always straightforward, because with a dog, one of the best ways to know a dog really, really loved its food is that the dog promptly throws up because it ate too quickly and it filled its stomach up too much and its stomach emptied itself. So throwing up is actually a way to say, hey, thumbs up. If you're in that industry, you would know how to interpret that behavior. There was, however, a pet food flavor panel. This was not at the place I went. They use animals, but there was a group of Canadians who trained a sensory analysis panel to be, was it the cat food flavor panel? I don't know if these people still meet, if they still exist, but they did. They were trained, and the idea was that these folks would familiarize themselves with the whole spectrum of flavors in canned cat food. We're talking the wet stuff. And they not only They really had to get right down into it. They had to hold it in their mouth and move it around the mouth for a few seconds and then swallow a portion. And they separated the meat chunk portion from the gravy gel. So really, this was above and beyond the call of duty. I can't imagine who volunteered for this. But anyway, the idea was that they would then, they would be able to sort of be a crack the code and translate the mute preferences of cats. You know, if cats seemed to be enjoying one particular cat food, then they could taste it and then say, oh, well, this is what makes this cat food stand out, whatever. So there were applications for that, but I say that it caught on in the industry as a way to evaluate the popularity of pet food among pets.
It sounds more like an elaborate practical joke. And of course, as you mentioned, I mean, really, the various flavours of cat food and dog food are for human consumption anyway, in terms of our choice, because really the cats and dogs don't care.
Well, yeah, they care somewhat, but they don't care necessarily as much as the owner. So you something, I mean, dogs are very scent-driven. So if you have something that really appeals to a dog, it may be like some compound like cadaverine or putrescine, you know, something that the owner doesn't want to smell at all, ever. So you have to choose something that appeals to both the owner and the pet if you're going to be a successful pet food manufacturer.
Let's stay in and around the mouth then. We're going to begin our journey with something. We're going to dive straight into ickiness, something that people find overwhelmingly disgusting sometimes, saliva.
Yeah.
It's interesting to start with why. You know, it does seem odd that we find saliva so foul.
Yeah, especially given that it's in our mouths all the time, and we welcome it. You definitely want saliva. It's a positive thing until the point in which it passes the lips, it leaves the lips. And there's a researcher at the University of Pennsylvania, or I think he's still there, Paul Rosen, who did a lot of work in the psychology of disgust. And he got really into saliva at a certain point and looking at it as you could define the microanatomy of the self. Like, where does the self begin and end? If you have food on your tongue that's chewed with saliva and you stick out your tongue, do you now find that food so disgusting that you won't pull it back in your mouth? No, no. So the tongue is part of the self, even when it's sticking out of the body. The lips were pretty okay with that, but that's culturally depends. In Brahmin Indian culture, just saliva on the lips is a ritual pollutant. So there's a little bit of a cultural element. And then he talked about how you extend the boundaries of the self to include your loved ones, your children, your lover. You don't have a problem with their, not just saliva, but their other body products as well. You know, their semen is something. It's like if it's somebody, someone you love, you're like, yeah, you're okay with that. Exactly. Exactly. Not everybody. Breast milk is another one where you can't, like someone in New York made cheese from his wife's breast milk to serve at the restaurant, and it was a huge media thing, and people were outraged. Oh my God! But it's just milk. It's milk. It's cheese. But it's if it strays from the confines of the self or the family, then it becomes this taboo substance. It's fascinating.
There's a famous incident in London a couple of years back. I think you do mention this in the book, where a restaurant in London, they were selling ice cream made from breast milk, and they only got away with it a couple of weeks, and then they were stopped from selling it. But I think it did very well. It was quite expensive, but I think it did well in the couple of weeks.
Did they pasteurize the breast milk?
I don't know, to be honest.
I wonder.
I wouldn't have thought so.
What if that was the objection, that it was essentially being used as raw milk?
Oh, I'm sure if it was pasteurized, that'd have been fine.
Yeah.
I guess the next question is, and it seems quite an obvious one, but it gets more interesting. What is the function of saliva? Because you go into the fact that there's actually, well, there's different types of saliva, isn't there? Which, again, is not something I was aware of being a person that produces my own saliva. That's the first time I've come across this idea.
As a spitter. I wasn't aware of that either. There's two kinds, stimulated and unstimulated. Unstimulated is just the background kind that's there in small, it's being produced in small amounts all the time. And that's the kind of slimy mucoid stuff that makes saliva so upsetting. The other one, stimulated saliva, is stimulated by chewing predominantly. And that, you look at it, you can collect it fairly easily using you can collect it. Anyway, you can then have it in a little beaker, which, and it looks and tastes like water. It's 90-something percent water with some minerals and enzymes in it. But you could never get anybody, even though it looks, it just, it's a very pretty looking substance. It's like water, clean, pure water, but no one, not even Erica Saletti, the saliva researcher who I visited, will drink their own saliva. I couldn't do it either.
I was going to bring in Erica, the, I think she's Italian, isn't she? But it was in Holland. You're visiting in a lab in Holland. So what does a saliva researcher do?
Yeah, well, she's looking at, oh gosh, she wrote an entire book on emulsions. I mean, she's looking at it in a very, she's taken it to a deeper level than I was actually interested in, but she, all of these things about saliva, I had no idea. For example, the antibacterial properties of saliva, the antiviral properties, one of the very basic things that saliva does, I had no idea, is that it, when you drink something acidic, wine or citrus or cola, you get this gush of stimulated saliva that is diluting the acid, so your enamel of your teeth doesn't dissolve. The acid rain, like the pH of 2 or 3, which these substances like wine and cola, that will just literally soften your tooth enamel and damage it and destroy it. So your saliva is like coming in like the cavalry. You can feel that if you take a sip of red wine. You can actually feel this gush of saliva if you're paying attention. So she's off in her own world of emulsions and mucoid strands. But I was more interested in just in sort of the basic things that saliva does for us day to day.
You mentioned there the antiseptic properties of it. And I mean, I think people do have some concept of that, even if it's like a sort of old wives' tale.
Yeah.
You do lick your children, dab your children's wounds with a bit of saliva, and of course animals lick themselves, don't they? See, what is the truth of this?
Yeah, they've done studies. There are studies. Someone looked at, it was a rodent study, I can't remember if it was mice or rats, I think it was mice. They prevented one of them from applying saliva to the wound, and although it could still lick it, it's just good. Anyway, we don't want to think about how that was done. But the wound, that mouse that couldn't apply saliva, the wound healed much more slowly than the mouse that was allowed to lick its wound. And wounds in the mouth heal faster than wounds on the skin, by and large, in humans. And also that notion that human bites, if you get a human bite, that you have to quickly get antibiotics because it'll be just horribly infected is not true. There was a study, one of the emergency medicine journals did a study where they looked at untreated human bites, and there were 51 cases, I think, and one or two became infected. Most of them were fine. So saliva has this bum rap, perceived to be this fetid, horrible, dangerous, infective thing, when in fact, yeah, your mouth is a lovely place for bacteria to grow. So for that reason, you need these defenses. Your saliva is one of your defenses. I mean, stomach acid also, part of its job is to kill bacteria. So you have these defenses, but it starts in the mouth.
You mentioned a while back as well the fact that there are enzymes in your saliva as well. This is another way in which there's good stuff in saliva. So tell us about the enzymes. What do they do?
Yeah, well, there's the main enzyme in saliva is amylase, which I think is a lovely word. Amylase breaks down starch, and so digestion even begins in the mouth, actually. If you eat bread, sometimes after you've mixed it with saliva, you get a sweet taste. That's, you know, breaking the starch down to simple sugars, and it's something you can actually taste it happening. And the other thing I love about this is that amylase and also lipase, there's a little bit of the fat breaking down enzyme in saliva. Babies have a lot of lipase in their saliva. But these enzymes are in laundry detergent, because if you think about it, the food that you put in your mouth is the same food you drop in your lap. So someone had the bright idea to take digestive enzymes and include them in laundry detergent and also dishwasher detergent. So these enzymes, I mean, they're not taken from human digestive tracts. They can genetically program microorganisms to produce the enzymes. But those are the enzymes, lipase, amylase, and proteinase, which breaks down proteins. And so that's the laundry detergent is kind of a digestive tract.
Eating the stains off of your washing as it clothes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's eating the leftovers that your guests didn't want.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny, and this week I'm talking to Mary Roach about her book Gulp, Adventures on the Alimentary Canal. So, Mary, in the first part of the show we were talking about the mouth, around about the mouth, and we're going to go towards the stomach now, and the guts of the digestive system, for want of a better word. First of all, tell us the story of the amazing relationship between Alexis St. Martin and William Beaumont. Who were they?
Yeah, Alexis St. Martin became a professional stomach. He didn't start out that way. He started out as a fur trapper in the Michigan Territories in the early 1800s. 1822 is when the story begins. He was shot in the side. Shotgun blew a hole in his stomach, and he was treated by an American surgeon named William Beaumont, who was at the military outpost near the fur trading post. So they treated the boy with the hole in his stomach, and at a certain point, William Beaumont, who was a very career-driven man and a man who wanted to enhance his reputation and earn the respect of his peers, a light bulb went off above his head, and he's like, you know what, when that lad lies on his side, I can look into the stomach and I can see digestion at work, and what if I were to get a mesh bag on a string and I were to lower pieces of food in there and I were to see what happens and I could take some of those juices out and study them? And he did literally hundreds of experiments on Alexis St. Martin, the boy with the hole in his stomach. When I say boy, he's 18. He's like 18 when this all began. A lad. He was a lad. And so I was just curious about the relationship between them. It was a kind of a mutual use and despise situation. They didn't have a whole lot of fondness for each other, but each one was getting something from the relationship. Alexis St. Martin, the hole, was paid, and he would take off from time to time. He drank a lot. He would run out of money. He'd come back and sign on for another stint as a patent digester, as somebody called him. And then he'd get fed up, and he'd take off, and Beaumont would be like, "Ah, Alexis St. Martin, you betray me." And Beaumont had this kind of arrogant attitude that, you know, you lowly trapper guy, you should happily dedicate your life to the improvement of human knowledge, to the god of science. You should be honored to play this role in the discovery process. And of course, Alexis St. Martin's like, "Ah, give me $10. He doesn't care. And so the two of them never understood each other, but they remained connected for 30-some years, back and on and off. So,
in terms of Alexis St. Martin's use in the furthering of human knowledge, describe what William Beaumont's experiments actually were, what he actually did.
Wanted to figure out was, is the process of digestion a chemical process or is it mechanical? In other words, those juices in there, did they break it down or do the contractions of the stomach break it down?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of the things that he was looking at. In fact, in the 1600s, there were a couple of researchers, Italian scientists, who had looked at this in animals and also in themselves by swallowing food and then regurgitating. But they would put food in a little cage such that it couldn't be crushed by mechanical action, and then they saw that it had to be. So they had figured, pretty much this had been already figured out. I guess Beaumont hadn't read the works of these particular Italian researchers, but or maybe he just wanted to look specifically at human digestion, which, because there are a lot of interspecies differences in how food is broken down, whether it's by bacterial action, chemical action, mechanical action. So he was trying to document how it works in humans. And he did that very thoroughly. And he also looked at things like, how does the weather affect digestion, which seemed less critical to me. It was like, experiment number 16, the weatherman's got the barometric pressure, and he's looking at how long does it take for this meat to break down in a little mesh bag. So those seemed less vital. What else did Beaumont? The other thing he looked at is whether these juices, the digestive juices, would work outside the body. So he would kind of suction out Alexis St. Martin's gastric acid and enzymes into a test tube, and then have Alexis St. Martin strap the test tube under his armpit to have the body heat and see if digestion would happen in a test tube. And like basically debunking this notion that there has to be the body provides a vital force, that the body is, that outside the body it wouldn't work. I think that's a concern that has to do with theories that were kicked around at the time about the vital force of the body. But anyway, he did a lot of work with that too.
And the other thing he would do, just to bring the, if we could raise the ickiness factor of this, and even more, he was basically regularly tasting it as well.
He did, at least once anyway, he did apply his tongue to the lining of the stomach. And that was, and of course, I just picture that. I'm just trying to, like, walking into the room and going, oh, I'm sorry, oh, excuse me. But at that time, physicians did use taste and smell, or taste predominantly, to as a diagnostic tool. Like, you can, like, in diabetics, you can actually taste the sugar. I guess it's in the blood or the urine, I'm not sure. But they would use taste diagnostically. It wasn't that untoward a thing to do. So I think that was part of it. But I didn't know that at the time, and I just read that, and I thought, indeed, really? Like, it just seems like an interesting, you know, because Alexis St. Martin, you know, he was illiterate. He didn't have a background in science, and he must have had just sort of the vaguest notion of what this guy was doing and why. And then when he bent down to taste the lining of his stomach, that must have been a very odd afternoon.
Yeah, that one would have been awkward, I think, definitely.
Possibly that's around the time Alexis St. Martin took off and left.
And he takes off and he leaves, and then eventually he dies. And then even his end is quite interesting, isn't it? Because
William Beaumont, with the help of the famous stomach, he became fairly well known as a pioneering experimental physician. He published a book, not a bestseller, Observations and Experiments in the Gastric Juice. The title alone, yeah, doesn't secure your spot in the bestseller list. But he became fairly well known in medical circles. And so, yeah, he knew a fair amount. He knew a lot of well-known physicians. One of them, William Osler, I believe his name was. And Beaumont died before Alexis St. Martin died. But Alexis St. Martin was well enough known as the famous stomach that when he died, William Osler tried to come for the stomach, and the family sent a telegraph to Osler saying, do not come for autopsy, we'll be killed. So people wanted to get the stomach for, they had those cabinets of curiosity and museums of strange and interesting medical oddities and specimens. So there was, people really wanted it. It was kind of like that, who's that famous giant who is buried and people dug him up. And anyway, if you had a peculiarity, anatomical peculiarity, and you died around that time, you had to really safeguard your tomb if you didn't want to end up in somebody's museum.
It seemed incredible that Alexis and Martin could have lived for so long with basically just a hole from the outside into his stomach. But of course, actually, this is, I mean, it's quite a regular, I mean, it's a teaching tool. You can get a cow with a fistulated stomach, with a hole in its stomach. And of course, inevitably, as is usual with your books, describe to us what it's like to stick your arm into a cow's stomach, Mary.
Yeah, okay, cow, and I should say that, in fact, the fistulated hole, it's Alexis St. Martin sort of scenario. It's the same kind of hole, and it's used not just for the entertainment of writers, although it does serve that purpose. It's also used to test, they put little bags of different types of feed, similar to what Beaumont was doing with Alexis St. Martin, in a little mesh bag, pull it out, see if it was digested, see how long it took. So anyway, I paid a visit to one of the fistulated cows at UC Davis here in California, and the rumen is the particular stomach, and that is the main stomach. It doesn't operate the same way the human stomach does. It's a bacterial fermentation pit. There's a lot of bacteria in there, whereas our stomach, we've got gastric acid, which kills bacteria. The cow's rumen is a composter, really. So it's like hot in there. You put your arm, first you put on a shoulder-length plastic glove, which is more commonly used by artificial inseminators. It's kind of stunning that it has to be shoulder length for artificial inseminators. How far are you going? So you put that on, and of course I've showed up, you know, when I go to do an interview, I wear a skirt. I'm dressed in like this sort of nice skirt and kitten heels, and I'm being led through the cow pasture, and it's, you know, there's a lot of flies and cow crap. And so anyway, there I am in my little outfit with my arm, and I'm all the way up to the shoulder inside this cow. I mean, there's photographs of this, and it's very bizarre looking. And even then, I can't reach the bottom of the room, and it's a giant fermentation composting vat. And it's also got these incredible muscular contractions going on, mixing it up. It felt more industrial than biological. It was a very It's a very strange experience. The cow is utterly bored. Utterly being, yeah, the wrong or the right word. The cow just could care less. It's used to it, and it's a very simple procedure. I mean, when I've heard of these cows, when I was a kid, I heard about a cow at, I thought it was Rutgers. I'm not sure, one of the East Coast schools. It has a window in its side. That's how it was described to me, and I pictured, you know, a windowsill and a sash and
curtains.
an actual, like you could open up the window and or like peer through a pane of glass. But it's not like that. It's just a sort of a stopper, and you like a plug that people have, young people have in their ears these days. Sometimes it's like a plug that is removable, and you can stick your arm through, and the cow could care less. I was just struck by how hot it is in there and how powerful those contractions are. I actually sort of worried, could I break a finger in here? It's quite an organ, the rumen.
That sort of description of the way that a stomach works in terms of how powerful a muscle it is comes up again a bit later in another chapter where you look at whether you can really survive being eaten alive. I mean, the classic thing is by a whale, but people get eaten by snakes and sharks and lions and things. So could you survive being eaten alive?
Well, the whale scenario, it depends on the whale. The sperm whale would be the most likely candidate because the sperm whale has a big enough a bit of opening into the first digestive compartment that a man could fit through. Because the sperm whale feeds by suction, and sometimes it eats very large squid. And so a sperm whale has taken in a squid larger than a man. So we know you could get in there in one piece. But and they are also the first compartment. The first stomach doesn't have it doesn't have gastric acid. So you would not have to deal with that, but you would have to deal with the fact that the sperm whale sort of chews its food with its stomach. It's got these powerful contractions. And so it would be a pretty uncomfortable place to be. I don't know. I think it's like 500 pounds per square inch or something like that. It's a fairly significant amount of force, so you would at the very least be very uncomfortable in there. You'd want to have a scuba tank, some oxygen, too. But that was the... The conclusion is that, yeah, you might survive for a while, but you'd be very, very uncomfortable and possibly dead. Yeah, I think that much pressure, you probably would be crushed or your bones would be broken. I mean, it would be very uncomfortable at the very least, yeah. You're not going to do, like you see in the illustrations, it's always like there's a little candle and a little table set up. That's not going to happen. There's no whale that's going to allow you to keep
the
it.
The roof lined with the whale's ribs.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
Okay, to finish this section off then, let's talk about, there's a byproduct of, an everyday byproduct of digestion that we're all familiar with, yet of course remain incredibly embarrassed by. So let's talk about gas, the science of farts, basically. So tell us a little bit about some of the research that's going on into gas.
There have been, well, before you even get to the research, what I found kind of amazing is that creativity that's gone into devising ways to capture the gas.
Yeah,
of course,
indeed.
To study it, you've got to trap it somehow. You've got to measure it. So there's been a variety of techniques. The earliest, let's skip the earliest, but the one from around the 50s was called a rectal tube, and that's just what you would imagine. You shove a tube up there, and it's attached to a balloon, and you gather it that way. But the rectal tube was dismissed as being very uncomfortable and tending to clog. So that was work that was done at Camden, I think it was, near Stratford-on-Avon. That was I have to say the guy's name who did the work, because it's fabulously appropriate. His name was Colin Leakey. Colin. We say Colin here, like Colin Powell. Colin Leakey is his name. So he did he did some work some decades back. More recently, there's been the flatographic technique, which is essentially a piece of paper on a clipboard, and you just make a mark every time you pass gas. But that's problematic, because depending on if you're the kind of dainty person that lets one bolus of gas out in many little squeakers, or you're somebody who blasts it out with gusto, you would have, say, 5 marks versus 1 mark on your flatographic tally, and that would be misleading in terms of how flatulent the person really was. So that's not the best technique. The other technique is the one that is used mostly today. And it's used also in diagnosing things like malabsorption of carbohydrates, because people produce a lot of hydrogen, or they produce a lot of gas. If they're not able to absorb it in the small intestine and it makes its way into the colon, they're very gassy. So the way you can measure it is you can have somebody breathe into a Mylar balloon, and that they measure how much hydrogen is on the breath, because most of flatulence is hydrogen is a big portion of it. So you can extrapolate from how much hydrogen is on the breath, you can extrapolate how much is coming out the anus. So the breath hydrogen test is the most scientific and the more commonly used approach today. And it's also a little less embarrassing than the other.
Although you do also talk about how that test can be skewed by your propensity to keep it in.
Yeah, that's right. I raised this question with, there's a guy at the Beano Corporation, Beano being these drops that make beans less, it's an enzyme that breaks them down on the plate rather than in your gut. So I said, if you are the kind of person that holds it in, you're going to absorb more of that hydrogen will be absorbed into the blood, therefore exhaled into the bag. So you, by holding it in, won't you appear to be extra gassy? I mean, well, it skews it in a way that seems wrong. And I asked this guy, Alan Kligerman, who's the head of research and development there, and he said, I guess so. I don't know. I really don't know the ultimate fate of a suppressed fart. It's speculation on my part, but I would think, yes, that if you're the type of dainty person that always holds it in, that hydrogen will be absorbed and come out on the breath, and therefore your breath hydrogen test would be artificially inflated.
Little Atoms, I'm Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Mary Roach about her book Gulp, Adventures on the Alimentary Canal. So Mary, we're going to move now from the stomach to the end of the line. You spent some time at Avenel State Prison in California. Can you tell us why?
I'd be glad to. I have a chapter on the rectum, because of course if you're going to cover the alimentary canal, that's where you end up. And I thought, well, what would be an appropriate setting for this chapter? And the rectum is, among other things, it's a storage facility. It stores it, and that's a good thing, because it buys you some time before you have to empty yourself out. So I thought, well, who would have an interesting perspective on the storage capacities and such of the rectum? And so I thought perhaps a prison, because there's a fair amount, at least in this country, of smuggling of contraband that goes on. And Avenel State Prison happens to have a problem with rectal smuggling of cell phones and tobacco are the two most common. So I thought it'd be interesting to pay a visit and have a conversation with, I figured that I'd probably be speaking with the people, the staff there, but the public affairs office was kind enough to set up an interview with an actual practitioner, somebody who uses his rectum in this way, and he was a very accommodating individual, very generous with his time.
Rectum was very accommodating.
Rectum was also very accommodating, and I think if you're serving a life sentence, you know, you've got plenty of time to talk to people about your rectum. it's such a garden variety thing to do there. Nobody thinks twice about it. It's like, you know, I saw a videotape from the visitor room, and there was there was footage of a guy who's sitting with his family playing a board game with his son. His wife passes a little bundle of something to him, and he reaches back and he puts it up his rectum as though he's just putting his wallet in his pocket. It doesn't change his expression. It takes him a second. It's nothing. It's just like putting something in your pocket. So it wasn't a particularly, you know, for him it was, you know, like talking about tire rotation or mulching your garden. It wasn't a particularly taboo subject for him. So it was fascinating, and that's good, because I was going to ask him some pretty unusual questions, like about, you know, how is it that you're able to override the defecation reflex, because some of these phones are pretty big, and the rectum operates by it's the stretch receptors that at a certain point, when it's full enough, it's going to give you this urge to go. And if you're manually overriding that for hours and hours, you get into trouble. And so we had a very explicit and strange conversation. So that was my trip to Ivanhoe State Prison.
You mentioned you mentioned obviously mobile phones, which is the common thing, mobile phones and plugs of tobacco. But obviously, as you've just said, mobile phones are getting ever bigger if we think of smartphones and things.
Yeah.
In the simplest possible terms, how much can you get up there?
Oh, well, there's a paper you need to read. I can't remember off the top of my head what the title of that. It's a medical journal paper, and it's a roundup of case reports of people who've come to the emergency room with things in the rectum, and it's stunning. I mean, there are the ones that were most striking were the ones where there was more than one object in a given rectum. Those were called collections, and one of them was lemon and cold cream jar. I mean, that's a lot. And one other one was, this one I told Rodriguez, the guy at Ivanhoe, I told him about this one, 402 stones. he said, the rectum will stretch, believe me.
The mind boggles, though, at what the stones or the cold cream was actually going to eventually
be used
for.
Yeah, I know. And I wish I'd known the average diameter of one of the stones. Are we talking pebbles? Are we talking boulders? What is a stone? I guess maybe it was a range of sizes. But and obviously these were individuals who were not smuggling contraband, but enjoying some sort of sensual pleasure from the stretch of their own rectum.
You say smuggling contraband. People will obviously be familiar with the idea of drug mules swallowing condoms full of drugs, or indeed shoving drugs up the rectum. But not necessarily in terms of drugs, which can obviously burst. That's a dangerous thing. But things like mobile phones. How dangerous is it? How often are there mishaps?
Well, it's sometimes it gets up so far that they can't reach it to pull it back out. That's when you end up in the emergency room, because you can't, for whatever reason, maybe the shape of it, because sometimes some of the things that are up there, like a jeweler's saw or a bottle of impulse body spray, they're irregular, they're hard, and they're irregularly shaped, and sometimes they're difficult to poop out. So you need medical help. There's one guy put concrete up there. Oh, my God. When it was wet, I'm like, didn't he realize it was going to dry and he's going to have a sidewalk in his ass? I mean, my God. But anyway, so it's more that they need help getting it out. It's not usually a case where the rectum bursts. It's just it's stuck. And you need to get it out, because otherwise you're not going to get anything out.
Otherwise you're going to be walking around with a big piece of concrete for the rest of your day. You're not going to find trousers.
Oh, my God. There was a whole paper on that one, the concrete enema. Oh, I think there were ping pong balls embedded in it for some reason that I don't even want to think about.
No, I think that's probably best left to the imagination.
Yeah.
We started off talking about taste and smell and obviously about eating. There was a craze or an idea in science that you could basically eat backwards. Tell us about this, about the idea that you could basically take on nutrients in reverse.
Yeah, the nutrient enema was a way to feed patients who couldn't feed forwards, basically. if you're unable to keep food down, or you had a blockage at some place along the alimentary canal, you could try to get the food in the back door, up the rectum. And this was before people regularly practiced. Now, of course, you could put a tube directly into the stomach, or you can do a nutrient, IV drip. But the nutrient enema was used fairly widely in the 1800s, 1700s even. And I think it was the 1700s, maybe it was just the 1800s. Anyway, the problem is that the colon and the rectum are not equipped, as the small intestine is, for absorbing nutrients. So you're limited in what you can absorb that way. But you can. I mean, you could prolong someone's life. You could definitely keep them hydrated, glucose, salt, some short-chain fatty acids. I mean, so there's certain things you can absorb that way. You can also deliver drugs quite effectively through the rectum, and they take action more quickly because they're not having to be processed by go through the stomach, be processed by the liver. They're directly being absorbed into the blood. So sometimes drugs are given that way. I think that pediatrics sometimes they'll give drugs that way. And ancient Maya would, because some of those drugs made, those hallucinogenic drugs made you throw up, they would give them rectally so that you didn't have the problem of throwing them up. So there's all these ancient Mayan vases with pictures of people appearing to be giving themselves enemas, but they're taking in this ritual hallucinogenic substance. It's almost a religious depiction, and it looks quite crass, but it's in the realm of more of a religion that you're going to have this, kind of holy vision from taking in this substance.
I love that scene in the book where you talk about how sort of anthropologists first made that revelation, that they'd obviously found these things before of somebody crashed down doing something and had never been able to really figure out what it was.
Yeah, there'd be these urns that were found in tombs or somebody with his butt in the air and some other person like squirting something into it, and then somebody else who looked like he was squatting down and wiping himself. And you're like, why would you decorate this, ceremonial vase with essentially not porn, but just something not dignified at all? And they didn't realize for quite some time that what was going on, that these were that this was a way to administer these hallucinogenic drugs.
Let's spend the last few minutes of the interview then talking about, I guess, when you can't go, when you have problems at that other end of the body. You introduce us to something called a megacolon. Tell us what that is.
Yeah, well, that is most often caused by this genetic condition called Hirschsprung's, where you don't have nerves down at the final stretch of the colon, so everything backs up. So you have this growing collection of waste that is stretching, and eventually it stretches out the colon. It damages the muscles, so they can't do what they need to do. So everything kind of spirals downward, and you end up, in some cases, with this tremendous stretched out, blocked up colon. And there's a famous one in the Moodle Museum in Philadelphia that's 28 inches around. It wears the same size pants I do. I mean, it's extraordinary. They removed 40 pounds of dried up waste matter that has been sitting there for a very long time. So needless to say, these individuals, if they're not treated, and it can be treated surgically, you can remove that paralyzed section of the colon. But if it's not diagnosed and somebody doesn't do that, you end up in danger of something called defecation-associated sudden death, which is you're pushing so hard you end up with a fatal heart arrhythmia.
And it's possible that this is what Elvis died of.
Yeah, that's right. On the death certificate, Elvis's death certificate, it says it was a heart arrhythmia that killed him. And and that's the same way the guy with the 28-inch colon was found on the floor by the toilet. So it's very likely that's what killed him. That's what was the moment of death. That's what was going on. He was trying very hard. Elvis had his colon, at the time of the autopsy, is three times the size of a normal colon. And in his case, it's unclear whether he had some genetic condition. If he had, it wasn't diagnosed, or whether it was a consequence of. I mean, he took a lot of prescription drugs and some things like painkillers, and some of the psychiatric drugs will shut down gut motility or slow it down significantly. So that certainly was contributing. So it's not to say that drugs weren't involved in his death. It's just it wasn't. It probably wasn't a straight overdose. He had a pretty weak heart, too, so that would have made sense with the whole defecation-associated sudden death theory.
Well, you mentioned that. You mentioned what that was the same thing that killed the guy in the... that was the owner, the original owner of the megacolon in the Mutter Museum. As dignified as it is to say, a lot of people die on the toilet. It's actually quite a dangerous thing. You talk about something called bedpan death as well. What's that?
In intensive care unit, a heart patient, anybody whose heart is not up to speed, has got any kind of a compromised heart, or somebody who's had a heart attack recently, they will put them, they'll be on stool softeners because if you're using a bedpan, that's the most awkward position to be in to try to, I mean, it's not natural. Squatting is the most natural position. Sitting is not as good as squatting, but it's better. But lying flat, it's very, you have to push much harder. So, and there's, it's happened enough that people have had that defecation-associated sudden death. It's happened enough that there is a term bedpan death, and that they put them on stool softeners just to help prevent that.
Just finally, then, let's. A lot of people suffer from constipation. It's a, you know, it's a common ailment. Let's talk about some of the solutions, some of the methods that have been come up with in the past to tackle constipation. I think the one I'd really like to finish with is the 17th century. Physician Thomas Sydenham's kitten therapy.
Chronic, severe constipation or obstinate constipation, as it was sometimes known, and then for a while they shortened it to obstipation, obstinate constipation. Anyway, the approaches tend to be similar to what a plumber would employ. You can flush it out, or you can snake it. You know, you can. That is to say, you can. Put some water up there. You can try to flush it out, or you can. One of the things that was done was having people swallow lead shot or mercury, even to kind of break it apart, to try to break it up mechanically. There was a period of time where electricity was used to stimulate evacuation. There was one great quote. Some guy said, "Efficacious. I could hardly get out of the way in time." And the physician's comment, but. The loveliest remedy was, Thomas Sydenham, who recommended a live kitten be kept upon the belly for a number of hours or days. I can't remember how long.
I think it was 3 days.
It was a long time. Yeah. And the person, somebody speculated that perhaps it was just sort of a soothing thing while it was, you know, hoping it would clear up on its own, because sometimes constipation just clears up on its own, and maybe that was just would make the person feel better to have a kitten there, but they could. I have no idea why, and he didn't explain. He didn't explain why you would have a kitten on your belly. But and I thought maybe he thought the kneading actions, but that doesn't make any. That's just a kitten. The kneading of a kitten is going to break anything up. I mean, they would. There was also there was some cadaver work that in which people were trying to see, like, could you put your entire hand up there and grab it and pull it out? So there was also that approach of just manually going in and grabbing the stuff and pulling it out. There were a series of cadaver studies where they're sort of trying to figure out how far up can you go with your hand.
I think that's a perfect point for us to end on, isn't it?
I think so.
I've been talking to Mary Roach, and we've been talking about her latest book, Gulp, Adventures on the Alimentary Canal, which is out in the UK from One World Publications and came out at the beginning of April. Mary, thanks very much for talking to Little Atoms again.
Oh, my pleasure, entirely.
I'm Helen Zaltzman. You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. You can find the Little Atoms podcast on iTunes, and you can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms. If you'd like to donate a little money to support the show, you can do so at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.